Coming up on Digital Music Trends, we talk about a potential Google streaming service, Spotify's deal with Ford, some interesting figures from Billboard's Moneymakers list, Harlem Shake, the IFPI 2012 report, and Radio 1's playlisting. This is Digital Music Trends, episode 122, recorded on the 27th of February, 2013. So hello, everyone, and welcome to DMT, the weekly show bringing you the latest news in music tech and available as audio and video. So you can find DMT on a variety of channels, iTunes for starters, but also any podcatcher, SoundCloud, YouTube, Mixcloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio. So this week on the show, I have two great guests, starting with Matthew Horn in his first time on DMT. So Matthew's previous gigs include Universal Music, Sony Music, and Last.fm, with a focus on product development and strategy. So, hey, Matt, and great to have you on. How's it going?
I'm good. Thank you. Glad to be here. Thanks.
And back with us from digital marketing consultancy Motive Unknown is Darren Hemming. So, hi, Darren, and great to have you back as well.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Cool. So this week, we're going to start by talking about Google. I think it's only fair, as they announced, they didn't announce anything, but the Financial Times reported on Friday that Google is in talks with labels and publishers to start a new streaming service that would compete with the likes of Spotify, Deezer, and Rhapsody, and the upcoming Daisy as well, of course. So the FT maintained that the launch date is imminent, but The Verge actually published another report the day after, a day later, saying that they, according to their sources, the service wouldn't really be able to go live until Q3 of this year. So first of all, you know, this is a huge news for the industry if Google does go ahead with this. You know, of course, Google has a huge involvement in music, as YouTube is the biggest music consumption space in the world for most people, especially a younger generation. And it has made some efforts with Google Play, but they haven't really gone very far in terms of music sales. So first of all, what is your first reaction, Matt, on hearing this news and hearing that Google wants to get into the space?
You mean wants to try again, basically? They've had a couple of shots at this. I mean, when I was at Sony, we definitely had conversations on a number of levels, and this is yet round, I don't know, 575, I think.
Yeah,
but it's good to hear that they're back, right? And I, for my friends who are working in the conversations with them now, and it's definitely they're in conversations. Google is over a negotiator in Europe, and we're actually seeing some motion. And you know, once again, you're going to expect them to come into this and for the labels to hit right back with the piracy question, right? And the question of search and search results. So, not surprised. I think The Verge is right. It's not going to happen until later this year.
Yeah.
Just there's lots of stuff to work out, but I think it's important that they try to make this step. You know, I don't think Play is enough from a music space. They've got to have more than that with their device strategy and with Android. You've got to have more. So not surprised to hear them stepping back in, and I think it's welcome. More players there, they are the better.
Yeah, of course. And Darren, of course, Google is kind of like a sprawling giant in the sense that it has so many divisions, and YouTube is still kind of a separate company, but it is part of Google. You know, how do you feel this service could, like, you know, interlace with the stuff like G+ and YouTube and all that?
I mean, I think personally where YouTube goes, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Google themselves don't quite know how that can weave in, because it's such a kind of uncontrolled environment with the user uploads and the fact that they can't kind of order that data in a particularly kind of usable way. You know, the fact that it's such a kind of sprawling mess compared to something like, I don't know, Vivo, where you've got, you know, it's very controlled, very ordered data getting uploaded and all that kind of thing, means I would imagine that they would probably treat it as kind of being, you know, over there, while the, you know, the streaming service may remain over here for the time being. I mean, I would think the strategy, or the wiser strategy, would be to leave the two separate for the time being and just negotiate around, you know, the music platform itself, which, yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's good news, really. I mean, I'm sure it's sort of always tempered with that slight concern that these people will start throwing their weight around much further down the line in a kind of iTunes manner to dictate terms. So obviously there's a slight caveat around that. But in terms of competition in the marketplace and, you know, and the things that they could do, I think it's really interesting. But I think, yeah, for the time being, YouTube will sort of, I suspect I wouldn't be at all surprised if their stock response is something to the effect of YouTube is our video platform, yeah, and you know, the forthcoming music service is an audio platform, and for now, never the twain shall meet. But
all my conversations with people play exactly what Darren's saying on this, right? I mean, the YouTube team, YouTube music team, very strong, got a lot of great stuff going on, but the connection hasn't yet been made, I don't think, with these guys. And I think that to negotiate that when it's still in flux makes sense to me, that they would be saying, this is the music service and this is YouTube video. Yes, there's potentially some synergies there, but if they're coming out of the box with something that is already integrated, I'm going to be incredibly surprised given how fraught those negotiations already are.
Yeah.
Me as well, because everyone's worried about the piracy thing. But, you know, we're talking about a time when there's an antitrust lawsuit about Google kind of allegedly overplacing its own products, you know, ahead of others in their search results. So the minute they've got their own audio platform, one would assume that there's a high likelihood that the piracy things may very quietly start to vanish all the more, because they will then have an extremely vested interest in pushing their own platform. And, you know, I suspect there'll be a hilarious point 2 years down the line where they're being sued for over-promoting their own legal audio platform over other platforms, and the piracy things dropped out of the picture. But yeah, we'll see. But I think it's not a point I've seen made yet, which I was quite surprised at.
Yeah.
So it'd be good to see. But in the main, I think it's a good thing, right? I mean, it's nice, isn't it? At the moment, to now have many players in the marketplace, that's what everyone wants, because we're, you know, emerging from a period where there's only been a couple and it's been a rather poor situation to be in. So I'm all for it.
Yeah, and one thing that was interesting for me on the Financial Times article as well was the fact that they really stressed the fact that Google is trying to diversify its revenue streams, as you know, 95% of its revenue still comes from the advertising based, you know, the search model that they have. That to me is really interesting, because, and I don't really believe in that, just because the fact is that as much as streaming services can be big cash, big revenue generators, they don't generate profits given the amount of royalties that have to be paid. You know, I think the figures on Spotify that, you know, somewhere between 70-75% of their revenues have to be paid back as royalties. So it's not really a profitable business for Google to enter if the goal is to expand its revenues on that front.
If your goal, Andrea, is to expand engagement and time spent and value around your other products, which they clearly would, that's clearly where the value is. So even if, while it may not be a direct subscription revenue, the additional materials around it is where they're absolutely could be looking for more revenue streams, which is where most services should be looking for revenue streams at this point. If you're only looking at your subscription revenue as your only source, you're desperately deluded.
Yeah, and Darren, you got an Nexus 4. We were having a look at it last night. So how do you feel like, for example, if the Google Music streaming service was to be integrated directly into Android as you purchase a phone, that would change the way, you know, you decide what service to go for? I mean, not you personally, because of course, you know, we are aware of all the different services, and you know, we are make a conscious choice, but for the average consumer.
I mean, it's funny. I don't know if it's because I've switched to a Nexus 4. I definitely feel like maybe a Stockholm syndrome setting in, but I do find myself looking more at Android as a platform and thinking, just in terms of sheer numbers, there's got to be a compelling argument for this kind of stuff. You know, if a streaming music platform comes in that can be seamlessly added to these handsets, then it can only be a good thing. I mean, I think it's interesting because, you know, we had comes with music with Nokia and stuff like that, and that kind of died a quiet death in most territories. I think it did well in the Far East. I don't know what its current state is, to be frank. But, you know, and people could hold that up as an example of sort of how not to do this. But equally, I think people could have held up sort of Napster as an example, you know, the sort of second incarnation of, you know, which is kind of the Spotify model, really, as it just was a bit too early. And I wonder if the same thing could be said of Comes of Music, that it just wasn't, you know, the marketplace wasn't ready for it. And maybe they are more ready now for things that are integrated onto devices. But yeah, I mean, I think it would make for a fairly compelling sell. I think it's never a given, because I think it's entirely where the value is.
Yeah.
But as we're seeing elsewhere, you know, Universal have made it clear that they would really like to explore kind of being able to do, you know, bulk, you know, deals with mobile operators, such that, you know, comes with whatever music service of choice, you know, and they seem to be now very open to exploring that area, understanding that there's a massive economy of scale play there. So, yeah, I think it would be good to see. And it's interesting. I mean, it kind of diversifies onto a broader topic, I think. But, part of the reason I switched to the Nexus 4 was just because I was tiring generally of the sort of locked-in environment that Apple has. And I think things like this will further chip away at that, and I think it's... I think that's a good thing, really. I mean, I like the fact that now you're not kind of in a one-horse race and that, you're seeing not just Android emerging as something usable, but kind of Firefox OS just got announced, and you've got this Tizen thing for Samsung. You've got the Ubuntu mobile OS. There's all these kind of things coming along that are just broadening the environment, and I think that's all good for business. So, yeah, I mean, I'm all for it. I think it'll be good to see.
Matt, you have a lot of experience on product development as well, and looking after sort of product integration type stuff. Looking at projects like Google Glass, for example, do you think Google needs, as far as integration is concerned, to have a streaming service which can be used, across Android and Google Glass? And a variety of different services and can be seamlessly integrated within its own environment. And that's maybe like another part of the play, which is why they need their own service.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you think you look at how Nokia has, for the Lumia, made Nokia Music, which they were all over MIDM with, and they're spending a lot of time focusing on Google Music as a utility part of why you should have that phone, right?
Yeah.
Music is part of so many people's lives, and it's such an important part of the personal device. And they're mobile only focused on this. Have you used Mix Radio? It's quite good. It's actually among the best radio services I've seen. They do a decent job at it. It's got a long way to go. It's miles better than Comes With Music was as an offering.
Yeah.
And as far as I understand, it's been in the market, 18 months now? It's successful for them as a product, despite this tiny number of people who can currently get it because of the handset challenge that Nokia has.
Yeah.
But if you look at any of the handset manufacturers or OS makers of mobile, you must have strong services integrated and strong platform. The device is only as good as the services available on it. And so without having a great music offering of some level, be it your own or one that you partnered with, I still think not enough people are partnering. I was really impressed by, you guys know Move, MUVE in the States, their Cricket platform. Quietly, not a lot of people have talked about it here, but they passed 1 million subscribers, right?
Yeah, similar thing to Spotify. Yeah,
that's Spotify territory for a company that's only available on a handset. That actually really shows you how immature this market is still, right? And despite all the hype that's been spent on Spotify and the money that they've spent to launch this, it is still a pretty open platform. And the mobile-only services, the ones that are designed for and in mobile, I'm including not just handsets but tablets and products like Glass, is still pretty amazingly open. So you've got to be working with either a partner, like Move is hoping to license this to now carriers and everyone else. I think it's attractive for carriers to not have it tied to a handset manufacturer, quite strong, I think. You have to have it. Do I think that Glass needs a music product to start? Nah. I think Glass should probably stick more with life blogging and photo stuff to start, right? More so than I think that they need a heads up display for my Katy Perry playlists.
Yeah, sure. And moving on from a direct, sort of streaming talk to a streaming and car talk, that's another space really that is really super important to get streaming to the mainstream. So, of course, right now, we're really limited to talking about streaming in the car when it comes to the US, because in Europe, there aren't really that many connected cars, and people haven't really, the manufacturers haven't really pushed it that much over here yet. But in the States, of course, you have the Sirius XM, which has a huge consumer base. But then you have Pandora, which is starting to get some attention. They had, I think, 1 million about users in the States that were using Pandora in the car last year, or last quarter, I think. And then you have other players that are coming in with services like, for example, Ford Sync, the AppLink service. And Spotify actually announced a partnership with Ford for integration in their Sync service at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. So The sync actually was already integrated with a few different streaming services, like I think Rhapsody and Mog were already integrated in the US. What's new here is that Ford is going to start introducing sync cars in Europe, starting with an SUV, sort of compact SUV, and then rolling it over to more vehicles throughout 2013. So Spotify will be able to leverage its own strong base here in Europe, as well as its base in the US. And the car space is really where the battle is going to be won or lost in terms of consumers' hearts and minds at this point, because of the ubiquity of music in cars. So I don't know, like, do you guys think that is it still going to be a battle between predetermined playlisted services, like, for example, Pandora, that can come in and really sweep the market? Or is there a space for on-demand streaming to play a part in car music? Darren?
I think it would be interesting, certainly, to watch it play out. I mean, I think there's a million factors there as regards, you know, what the market will respond to. And
yeah,
unfortunately, we haven't really seen a sort of what I would say is like a mass market adoption of these things to necessarily give, you know, significant insight as to what, you know, woman in Tesco's, I suppose, if you're going to, you know, stereotype, you know, would go for, whether they want just more of a radio thing. Because really, you know, obviously you're talking about a world at the moment where, you know, you have both in your car because you've got a radio and you've got a CD player or something. Or
yeah,
if your car's as ghetto as mine, you've still got a tape player in it. But,
nice.
You know, it's kind of, it's that environment where, you know, equally I do both. So, you know, maybe there's room for both. Is one an ad-supported service and another one is a subscription you pay for? I don't know, you know, and it would be very interesting to see. I think what's, for me, what felt like the big, big win of this is that, you know, even Spotify, I think, has struggled to get real coverage beyond, you know, I mean, we live in a world between us where we're all consuming lots of tech media, and obviously you can't get away from Spotify and those kind of circles. If they make any kind of move, it's covered extensively.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, if you were to drive to the local supermarket and just pick a random person, stop and ask them if they knew what Spotify is, I think you'd still be running a sort of 30% chance of them ever having heard of it. Now, you know, if you've then got someone like Ford running this stuff and running extensive advertising to talk about the platform and all those sorts of things, it's a kind of cultural win for both, you know, Spotify as a service, but for streaming media as well, you know, because it's then, it's kind of normalizing it in the eyes of, you know, the average Joe. And I think that right now that feels like the biggest victory that you know, they will have initially. I suspect the uptake will be fairly limited because people may not quite understand it yet. But who knows? You know, I mean, by all accounts, the integration's pretty good, the Spotify one, with sort of voice controls and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see. But yeah, going back to your point as to whether they'd opt for a radio-type environment or an on-demand, I really don't know. I'd be very curious to find out myself. I suspect you'll see a fairly reasonable split, but we'll see.
Yeah, and Matt, I wrote a piece last week as well where I was talking about how maybe Spotify should really stress its radio and playlisting component when marketing its service to the car. Do you think that that's maybe a good plan for them to make it really like easy for users to understand that yes, there is a radio option, and yes, you can just turn on music and let it go?
You know, I'll be curious to see how well Ford's Sync project works, right? That's actually a really good test model for this, and I want to really see what happens before I'm really willing to step in. I've been a bit of a car skeptic for most of the time. I think it's early.
Yeah,
there was a lot of pressure on us when I was at Last Tip. I'm like, we got to have a car thing. Pandora's going to be in the car. I'm like, let's see how it plays out first. We haven't really solved the audio. The advertising issues there are still pretty strong. There's a lot of issues that are still going to come up. The user experience, all that side of it, is not really strong. Someone made the point to me once about car stuff that if the time to market for technology in cars is so long, that if we had chosen now, the products that we're coming to market now would have probably had Friendster and not Facebook integration. I mean, it just kind of tells you how long the cycles are, right?
Yeah.
We just, social, you know, the trends move so quickly, and a car manufacturer's ability to move to that trend is hard, which is why it's good to see Ford dealing with this the way they are. An API is probably smarter than, you know, let's put connectors in the car, right? How many cars come with an old iPod connector now that is now useless for the new iPods?
Yeah.
You know, it's just really difficult to stay on top of that technology side of it. But assuming that they do get that done, and I think that's a big if, you know, There's the bandwidth questions of streaming versus cached music. There's all kinds of technical issues to go overcome. Yeah. And it's not consumer technology yet. It's just not consumer tech yet. So it's, to me, it's a, you know, right now, if I want music in my car from a streaming service, I plug in a jack and I leave the phone in there. And I actually don't think that's a bad solution for most people.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be the default solution for most people with music in cars for quite a while. So I'm curious to see if how Ford's service works, but you know, yeah, at some point we might expect to see, you know, an integration with cars that, that recognizes your phone when you bring it into the car and brings your presets with you, all those kind of things you might want to see. You know, when the kids get in the car with their phones, does it change? All those are all exciting things, but it's all science fiction right now for me.
Yeah. I mean, I have seen like real life examples, like videos and stuff for reviews of the sync system. And it is impressively accurate in voice recognition, at least for American English. So
that's a big
point. So that's interesting because, you know, it does feel like actually voice commands could be like a big thing that drives this in the car. At the same time, it's going to take such a long time for enough people to change their cars to connected devices that it's, I don't know. As you said, Matt, it's going to take a while for this to.
I don't hear people screaming for this, is my point, right? I don't know that there's. So with satellite radio in the US, there were some really clear good use cases for that, right? Satellite was fantastic because you can get very, really good programming to a lot of bad areas that had crap radio, right? So it was really nice to be able, there was some good use cases for that. I don't know that those cases go everywhere. It also took Sirius and XM a long time to get there to those things. And the fact is that market is good for them because there was an audience who was willing to pay $20 a month for something that they could get a lot of other places.
Yeah, sure.
It's interesting, though, your point about the, you know, whether you just plug in your handset, because it made me realize, you know, I wrote a thing on my own blog a while back about switching, you know, from an AirPlay environment, because I didn't particularly like the kind of totally locked down nature of AirPlay on what, you know, I then had my iPhone, and switching to Bluetooth, you know, and was sort of saying that, in my own home now, basically I've just got a bunch of Bluetooth receivers kind of in the lounge, in the kitchen, you know, next to my bed, and you just walk around with your phone in your pocket, and if I want to play music, well, then you just, you know, connect to the nearest receiver and off you go. And similarly, you know, you could apply the same in the car. And it's funny when you think how a phone is perfectly capable of doing voice recognition as well. So there's really, you know, your phone could perfectly handle this entire process. And you can, you know, get out of the car, walk away, and your wife gets in and all her stuff's there with on her phone. So, it makes a huge amount of sense.
Yeah.
The guys at Berg have a really great point about this, which is you should always look at a particular type of technology's life cycle. How frequently do you replace your car or things inside your car versus how frequently you replace your phone, right? Mm-hmm. And or refrigerator. Refrigerators, it's the excuse people always say, like, why are there no screens in refrigerators? I replace my refrigerator once every 20 years. Do I really want a screen of 20 years old technology in my phone? You don't want it.
Yeah.
So the question is with cars, is that something we think, certainly aftermarket radios are something that is a big deal, right? So people switch things in and out. I'd rather spend my money on upgrading my phone than I want to upgrade my car radio, right? That's kind of my – so I just don't think this is as big a consumer technology as everyone thinks it is. Mm. And while everyone chases it, it's a pretty moving target. We always had higher priority things at Last.fm from my perspective.
Sure.
And people like Pandora, I understand why they'd be chasing it. It makes a lot of sense for them. But even then, I think it's still a tough sell consumer-wise.
Yeah, sure. And it's always going to be, I mean, and in the States, especially just because of the coverage as well, you know, there's so many areas that are not covered by 3G still, and especially where you're driving around. So that's going to be a challenge for these services to actually find a way to either pre-cache a load of stuff.
Absolutely.
Whilst they're working or find a way to...
This is a precast situation, right? You're not gonna go, and if you lose, you know, you don't want to lose your radio when you go through a tunnel. You don't have to in this space. So yeah. IP radio should be cached.
Yeah, absolutely. So just closing on the streaming commentary, there was a very interesting article on Billboard, which was basically their analysis on their own Moneymaker's top 40 list. And aside from sort of the general considerations on the fact that the higher you go on the list, the higher the percentage of revenues that come from live, so like looking at the first two acts like Madonna and Bruce Springsteen, over 90% of the income in the US came from touring, and then that sort of percentage starts to dwindle down the lower on the list you go. The other interesting figure is that for artists that are lower on the list that are making $1 million or less in touring, recorded revenues were actually higher than the touring revenues. So that for me was a really interesting figure because it kind of, everybody's talking about Live as a savior of the industry, but if you look at artists that are successful, but that are not massively successful in the sense that the economy of scales don't allow them to really make so much profit on their tours, then recorded music is still big. And also there was an interesting question about demographics. They looked at older acts that maybe are making a lot of money on the live front because they can charge a lot of money for tickets. But for example, Rush, Neil Diamond, Elton John, and Rod Stewart earned little from streaming services. And acts like Barbra Streisand, for example, earned less than $1,000for streaming in the US, which is really very little. Whilst younger artists that maybe did far less successful tours brought in a much higher percentage of streaming revenues based on their touring income. So, for example, if you look at artists that did a million again or less in the list, they brought in an average of almost 200K on streaming, which is kind of 20% of their touring revenue, which is still quite a lot. So I just wanted to get a sense from you guys. Like, are you surprised by hearing these figures? I was in a sense, and even looking at projections for streaming, if it doubles or triples in the next 2 or 3 years, it could be that for artists that are earning a million or less, streaming could be almost 50% of their touring income, which is a lot. I don't know. What's your take, Matt?
I'm not surprised by those figures at all. Matt Locke, who's a consultant who was at Channel 4 for a long time and who now runs a great conference called The Story and a consultancy called Story Things, has a great theory about the patterns of attention these days, right? So patterns of attention have a lot to do with how people are experiencing and getting to the music and to the artists that they're in, discovering artists. And while we're seeing this very spiky way of discovery and new bands getting discovered, it's just not sustained, right? So the challenge for any artist is sustained attention. Not getting noticed the first time isn't good enough, right? So
yeah.
How fast did Harlem Shake rise and fall, and the difference between that and Gangnam Style, and just that, even something new can get noticed, but the mechanisms and the support for sustained use and sustained attention are just gone, right? They're just disappeared. And so it relates a lot to the radio stuff that we were talking about before we started the show, that I think is really worth coming back to at some point.
Sure.
I'm not surprised to see revenue not there yet for these services yet, because there's nothing sustains them. Whereas a workhorse like Dave Matthews Band, who has not had a major focus on them for a period of time, but has all the necessary support and infrastructure in Barbra Streisand for long-term engagement with their fans and long-term conversations with them, of course they're going to have strong revenue streams, be they in ticket or merch. When they decide to sell a fan package, any of those things are there for them. Without that infrastructure, without that ability to hit that audience, and Darren knows this better than most, right, as he works with artists, you're trying to build that infrastructure. And the low earners for you aren't there yet. They've got that initial spike, and I would almost guarantee you that some of those lesser-known artists are really looking at a spike, not sustained. A few of them have got a slow growth. Some of them have had a slow build.
Yeah.
But very few acts in 2012 had, a massive spike that stayed spiked. Right? They just didn't. Very few had that.
Yeah.
There'll be a number of people who had a slow build, and fantastic for the ones who did. Those are the real deals, and hopefully in 20 years we'll see some of those guys at the top end of this earning scale.
Yeah.
But it's just the patterns of attention today. It's not anything to do, I think, with, sure, the economics are hard for streaming services, but it's just not sustained.
Yeah. Yeah, and Darren, like looking at stuff like Harlem Shake, for example, of course, we've all heard about it, seen it to death, but the number one Billboard chart position really sealed the deal as something that has converted from purely a YouTube hit instantly to becoming an actual chart hit. And that happened like a lot quicker than it happened with Psy, for example. I think it took like Psy a couple of months to get to that position, and here it all happened in about 2.5 weeks. Which is insane. So for you as a digital marketing person, what's your take on how these memes and these viral hits are evolving? And do you think there's anything that you can take from these that or that any marketer really can take and try to apply to their campaigns? Or is it just like at this point, it's a complete luck of the draw and it's completely non-replicable at any level?
I wouldn't say it's non-replicable, but it's, yeah, I mean, obviously the first differentiator is that Psy was one video that everyone was watching. Harlem Shake is a meme where there are now an insane number of videos, all of which are getting a good number of views because no one's, well, I suppose now they might be slightly tiring of watching endless Harlem Shake 30-second clips. And that's another clever thing, is it's a 30-second video, and the meme is 30 seconds long because of the clip of audio. So it means you can digest a lot of them in a very short space of time and all that sort of stuff. So in terms of count for count, you know, one view of Gangnam Style is equivalent to about five or six views of different Harlem Shake videos. But, you know, on paper, it's a 5-to-1 ratio nonetheless. So it's not a surprise to see that happening. I tire greatly of kind of... retrospective wisdom applied to these things when they just, you know, come out of the blue.
Yeah.
And I love to see, you know, I saw this morning that Warner's are now all over Mad Decent, you know, for kind of label services, and they've done a deal.
Of course.
And I'm pretty sure, you know, Mad Decent peeling back a few months probably couldn't have got shot on the Warner's front doorstep. So, you know, it's just the way they go, and good on them, you know, good luck to them. I think it's great to see this stuff happen. In terms of whether it's something you can really kind of learn from, I mean, there's takeaways from it, you know, and there's certainly, you know, I think the whole approach with you know, Bao's track and the way in which they've monetized all of the content and not sought to cap it off does mirror one thing with Gangnam Style, in that, you know, I remember seeing interviews with, I think it was Scooter Braun and maybe even Psy himself, where they were saying, you know, part of the policy was that they don't get really, you know, heavy-handed about taking down other people doing similar versions. You know, they let that whole cultural moment live, and I think that's what you have to do, you know. But, yeah, I mean, for me, it's the broader takeaway is just understanding popular culture and understanding when you can make more of it, you know, and try and understand what you're going to get from that. So, you know, even last week I was working, you know, I worked with Alt-J, and Alt-J were obviously at the Brits. They had three nominations. And it was interesting, you know, even seeing friends sort of subsequent to that, going, oh, it's a shame they didn't win. And it's kind of like, well, no, they didn't win, but, you know, it's worth noting that they had twice the number of mentions on Twitter, you know, people just naming the band, which, you know, just across the board on Twitter, they had twice the number of people doing that on Brits Night as they did when they won the Mercury Prize. and we scored the highest chart position on Sunday ever in the campaign. So it's not about the winning. It was the being part of a big cultural event, a big popular moment, you know, in pop culture, and you know, and being able to capitalize on that, which in my case we did with kind of live promoted tweets that was rather hectic, but very, you know, very good, very interesting. And it's those sorts of things. So I think it's, you know, it's the not very sexy end of it in the sense of understanding, you know, how to make the most of these things, make sure that in the sense of, you know, Harlem Shake, obviously they've got the thing claimed, and that they've got it registered with Content ID, you know, YouTube's fingerprinting service to make the most of it, all those kinds of things, just to tick the boxes and make sure you get that coverage, you know. And it's good to see with Billboard that they've opened this stuff up to, you know, to include the YouTube views. But I found myself sort of, I thought I wouldn't agree with what Martin Talbot said from the OCC, because obviously in the UK, the OCC have said they won't be looking to include YouTube you know, views at the moment.
Yeah.
But he did, I think Martin made a very good point when he sort of said, you know, the Billboard Hot 100 was always a sort of cultural barometer rather than a sort of hard and fast, you know, singles chart. Yeah. And you know, the OCC runs a singles chart. They have a streaming chart, and he conceded that, you know, I think he did anyway, that there's a, you know, an argument for YouTube ultimately winding up in that maybe. But yeah, sort of, I could see the reasoning as to why they wouldn't include it in the UK one, because that's much more of a straight up singles tracks, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, I think there's stuff to learn. Certainly, there's always things to learn from everything in my case. But I, you know, I think these things that go ridiculously viral and become massive, you can't replicate that. You just hope to God that one day it involves an artist you're working with, you know, because it's manna from heaven when it does, I'm sure.
Of course, and but the other question is like looking at it from the perspective of an artist that maybe doesn't preventivate something like this happening, or you know, they have their own creative vision as to what they want to do with their music. And I had an example actually last week. I was looking into the story of this guy called Azaf Avidan, who did a track called One Day. There was a remix by DJ Wankelmuth and went viral on YouTube and got a ton of views and stuff. And his first reaction at hearing that the remix had been done and it was going crazy was to try and take it down. Of course, he didn't succeed because, you know, it's kind of tough if you come, you know, if you're in Israel and you're trying to get something down that's going viral elsewhere. And it was probably a good thing for him in the end because it did make his track popular, and by default he could actually distribute his record in Europe. But at the same time, it does beg the question of what can you do if you're an artist and the song gets taken away from you and becomes viral for something that you hadn't really any part of. So Matt, do you think that's something that artists are going to have to deal with more and more at this point?
I 100% agree with Darren. Don't make a business plan around a lightning strike, right? That's what these are. These are lightning strikes.
Yeah.
Any artist or any business or any product or anyone who wants to have a sustained career, they have to know it's made up of smaller moments, right? Yeah. And that's if you have one great moment, that's fantastic, right? Thank God lightning struck. Absolutely good. But anybody, you know, consumer behavior, audience behavior, fan behavior is all based on a number of small interactions that build to a great relationship with a band. And, you know, when you do get the lightning strike, or even if you get a minor strike of some kind, that's fantastic. It's a help, but it's really what you do afterwards and what you've done before that decides the success. Yeah. You know, certainly, I agree with that. There's certain boxes you check on doing this. Did we not take it down? Do we have content ID set up? All those are things that any basic marketer would have just ticked off quickly. But it's really move on to the, how do I continue to have a relationship with the people who got into this? Yeah. What is it? What are the entry points? How do we make the connections that we need to? You know, when we looked at, and anytime I was looking at any products that I've ever worked on, we always looked at the touch points around that main touch point. Right.
Yeah.
Where were they coming before? Where were they coming after? Where did they go afterwards? Were almost as important as the place where lightning struck. And so I think that that's really what any smart marketer or smart band's going to understand is, how do I create more small moments with these guys? How do I create repeated contact? And even if those are tiny, right? And in fact, five tiny interactions with a band that don't involve a sale or even a win on an award show are just as valuable as one where you had a sale that they never come back again because it was a trend, a fact.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's been interesting for me. I mean, I think there's certainly been periods where I've worked with artists and they do have a knee-jerk reaction to, you know, somebody else doing something, because I think artists generally like to retain a sense of control around what's going on. But I think equally, it's always very telling when you get the artists that understand that it's all good for business, you know.
Yeah.
And that simple thing of like, you know, no, you didn't think of it. No, you didn't execute it. But is it good for business? And the answer is yes. You know, and it's looking at that stuff. So in your example, Andrea, with the, you know, the DJ guy, it's kind of, yeah, you should look at it and sort of say, is this something that's just promoting me and pushing me further into, you know, the culture, the popular culture of the global internet? You know, and if it is, then leave it be. You know, as long as it's reflecting on you well and isn't, you know, devaluing you or your music in a manner to make a mockery of it, or, you know, make you a laughing stock, then,
yeah,
you know, I think these things should be embraced, you know. And, you know, there's a very long list of people who've done that and just let it be and have profited greatly as a result.
All right. Well, talking about laughing stocks, let's talk about the Radio 1 article that Matthew forwarded me. He forwarded me just before the show, literally, so I only just managed to skim through it. But basically, the bulk of the article published by The Guardian yesterday is that there was a bit of an uncovering on how the process of playlisting for Radio 1, which for US listeners is the biggest radio in the UK, you know, the most listened to radio in the UK, I think, still, is it? Yeah,
Radio 2 is larger.
Radio 2 is larger. Okay, so I guess like maybe the second one, and for sure like the one for the younger demographic. If you want to break
new artists,
Radio 1,
right?
Yeah,
it's the one. That's where you want to
be. And basically, you know, that it just there were some interns that started live tweeting some of the comments that are that were coming from the meetings where the playlisting is decided, and cast some light on how that process all works. So I don't know, Matt. Do you want to take that a little bit and explain a little bit what the background is?
I'm fascinated with this. We had a last time, and we did a lot of programming of radio, right? Personalized radio still had a programming methodology behind it. And they sound like, oh, the algorithm chooses. But really, there are some very solid concepts that radio programmers have that create the thing I was talking about earlier, which is sustainability, right?
Yeah.
We can all complain as much as we want about the repetition on radio and the fewest slots we have on that. But it's one of the last places that creates a sustained, shared culture sense of what's happening and what's hot.
Yeah. Right?
The U.S. has lost this. The 40 or so major markets in the U.S., there is no consistent way there is in the U.K., place where you can say, this is what's happening, this is what's hot, you know? And that has value. Radio is one of the last places where we have sustained focus and sustained playing and really builds a band's career over time. So I think it's enormously important that we as digital product guy people understand how radio works. And that's not to say we don't throw stones at the radio guys when they get it wrong, right? And I'm on the fence about, is this wrong or right, right? I mean, the transparency, I'm usually on the side of transparency. On the other hand, you know, a half-assed tweet from an intern about whether a song was liked or not liked isn't maybe really the watching the sausage being made that I want to see. I don't want to know what's going into radio if that's how it's happening.
Yeah.
At the same time, it is how it happens, right? I mean, so there's some, you know, should people like Darren trying to figure out how to game the intern, right? I mean, so oh, now we know who's tweeting, find out what they like, we can start to, that's a game I wouldn't want to be in, wouldn't want to be playing. But the idea that we do have places where there are still tastemakers in this aspect, it's one of the last places that still happens. And so some transparency is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how, Darren, you probably are on a less sanguine note about this, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, I'm troubled by the whole thing, really. It bothers me enormously because, it's tough to know where to begin. I mean, it's kind of, you know, they have a very difficult job to do. There's absolutely no two ways about it. So in playlisting, generally, there's a lot of decisions have to be made. So first of all, in terms of the whole live tweeting and stuff, I kind of share your view, Matt, that it's one of those where, you know, when you look at something, you're just thinking, nothing good can come from this. There really is. Like, if they liked it, it will be on the playlist anyway. So that's great. Like, I don't really, you know, and as the article kind of touched on, I'm not sure Theo from Hertz will be thanking them for their kind of fairly negative comments that they decided to tweet. And, you know, just across the board, you know when this stuff's happening because Twitter erupts from my peers. All set, they're just going, what the fuck are you doing? You know, kind of slagging off my bands and stuff. It's one of those things. I just don't think it, you know, some things should remain private and any more than I think I should live tweet what I say, you know, in a meeting when we're talking about the prospects of something getting on radio, what we all think about George Ogatoudis and his gang at Radio 1. There's no benefit to me live tweeting that at all. So no one does it. Not that I'm saying we sit there and slag them off, I hasten to add. But you know what I mean? It's just, it's a private conversation and it just, there's no merit there in that really coming out. But I think the bigger sort of issue I have around the playlisting is that I think there's a lot of hearsay, you know, and I hear a lot back from pluggers saying, you know, first it was they look at YouTube views, so we have to focus on YouTube views, and then the strategy is we must drive YouTube views. Then it broadened out to they're using Next Big Sound, and it's kind of like, okay, well then, so now we look at slightly broader topic. Now apparently they're using Music Metric because it's a British service. I'm assuming Music Metric have made contact, and so now they will use that. Hilariously, they don't pay for the proper Music Metric service. They all use the free one, is my understanding. So they don't actually get the full insight. So they just get kind of top line. And as a result, I think my problem with it is that it becomes rather a myopic way of studying this. And I think it, you know, I'm not actually massively in favor of judging things solely on metrics alone. I never have been. I think you have to run with a sort of gut feeling about how something is doing. And just, I think my overall beef with this, all of this, is it becomes a little bit a case of the tail wagging the dog. I don't like it when my strategies are being affected by a desire to push up specific metrics around a, you know, an artist in a bid to secure playlist. I totally understand that labels would want you to do that, and I fully get that, but it worries me a lot when it becomes, you know, that you're doing it specifically with Radio 1. And it goes beyond that into a slightly more worrying area, which is the degree to which then people are illegally buying, you know, plays and fans and all of this stuff in a bid to show sort of organic growth. It used to be done very clunkily, so you've got hilarious examples of a sort of graph going like this, just kind of overnight they say, what do you know, they got like 200,000 views. And now it's a lot more subtle, but it's a huge worry, and I think it really muddies the water for those of us who are, you know, steadfastly playing a legitimate, you know, route with this, you know. I hate it, because I really dislike the fact that when there is a band, you know, who are showing great potential and are getting a lot of press and all the right kind of cultural indicators are there, that you're then being told that you haven't got enough views or plays, and that therefore then you're being pushed to drive them. And then you can see why people do then think, well, sod it, I'll go and pay and just buy a bunch of them and go back to Radio 1 and go, there you go, it's now got a million views. You know what I mean? 24 hours, what do you know? What are the chances? You know, that's not good. And I just think, you know, I think it's easy. I mean, this sounds very much like a kind of anti-Radio 1 rant. It's not. I fully understand they have a very, very difficult job to do. I just wish that perhaps maybe there was, ironically, just more of a gut-feeling decision taken at their end, and perhaps a bit less of a focus on the data, because sometimes that then just leads to people trying to game the numbers, and that isn't a good thing for anybody. It doesn't bode well.
We used to always talk about data informed rather than data driven, right? I mean, you don't make decisions based on your product based on all the numbers. You have a hunch, you have an intuition, you have a hypothesis, like this is good, this is bad, this is really positive, and this is why I think so. And then you use the data to either reinforce or to challenge your hunch.
Yeah.
And sometimes you say, the numbers challenge me, but I know this is a hit or this is right, and you overread your numbers, right? And that's why the best programmers are who they are. That's why the John Peels of the world are who they were. They said, the numbers don't matter to me as much as my hunch is right on this one, and I think we can build those numbers together with the audience.
Yeah. I think it's hard because there's a couple of factors. I mean, the first is that Radio 1 is a kingmaker of a station. You know, if Radio 1 playlists your track, then it will see a response. You know, it's 99% guaranteed. Ergo, there's a degree to which you have all these conversations about the numbers and everything else, and then in the event you do get playlisted, obviously then all the numbers promptly shoot up. So, you know, there's a chicken and egg thing there.
Yeah.
But equally, I mean, I think it's just, you know, having the hunch and running with it is great, but I think there's also a problem which extends to the BBC and their kind of demographics. And, you know, at the moment there's another push for Radio 1 to drive down the demographics. So, you know, they're wanting to see not just that there's views, but that the views are with the right demographic, you know, which leads to people putting things on Vevo, because we all know it's kids watching Vevo. And it's really hard. I mean, I feel like they have an incredibly hard job to do, because within that, you know, they're now having to serve the BBC Director General and the board, who are saying we want far more listeners in the, you know, 13 to 18, because Radio 2 is now taking the, you know, the 21s on over or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they've got other things that they also have to go with. And perhaps I think at a commercial station there would be arguably much more space to run with just a gut feeling. And I think unfortunately Radio 1 have to also service their remit, which, you know, can compromise things further. But it's tricky for them. I genuinely feel for them. I think we all do. You know, I've had this discussion elsewhere. We all moan about Radio 1 and the way in which the playlisting can be a very murky area. But equally, I think everyone accepts that it's kind of a poison cup. You know, they don't have quite the freedom to run it as they would want to. I think if they did, maybe you'd see different things going on. It's a tough job. I really do wish that maybe, you know, I think you nailed it, Matt. It's kind of data informed rather than data driven at the moment. I think it goes slightly too far to the data driven side.
Yeah, because Matt, I was listening to Darren and a few other speakers a couple of weeks ago, I think, at the Roundhouse Rising event. It was just like a digital event put on by Generator to talk about sort of digital issues, but also inform sort of young artists and managers about what their options are. And the running theme when talking about like gates, for example, was that like gates are no-no to build a fan base, but they are okay if a radio asks you to get to X amount of Facebook likes or whatever, or Twitter followers to be able to be playlisted. So that's kind of where chasing the numbers to get the playlist really doesn't make sense, because if the radio is interested in the first place to playlist your track, why do they ask you? I mean, if you already have decent numbers, you know, of course, if you're a zero, you know, there's no arguing with them, but Why did it ask you to achieve a specific set of numbers if they believe the track would work with the audience that they have anyway? So yeah.
I mean, for me, certainly, you know, I've had it before where the feedback was that they would like to see, you know, a specific number of, you know, as a minimum number of total fans.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's certainly been instances where there's been discussions about, you know, putting up a light gate and doing stuff like that, which is the point at which things tend to get very, very tense because, as I said, it's tail wagging the dog.
You know, sure.
I rather resent being told how to do my strategies, you know.
It's an inaccurate metric. I mean, I think in general, I think it's a trendy metric that will likely go away over time. It just doesn't actually, to your point.
Yeah, it's just totally meaningless. You know, holding you to ransom and saying, click like on my Facebook page doesn't make you genuinely like my page. You know,
It's not a solid thing. So I do hope to see people. I mean, you mentioned Music Metric and Next Big Sound. And I was just looking, my old company, Sony, has a head of research up. And one of the requirements they've got for research is to work properly with Next Big Sound, right? To work properly. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing managers and I'm seeing, you know, people getting it right. I expect to see radio make the transition as well to better metrics. And those metrics will be, and some bands are different metrics, right? A band with a live focus and a real buzz around it, there's a live band like Palma Violets or someone, it's really clearly going to be a different vibe. And especially when it's festival season comes on, it's going to change things enormously. So, you know, we'll see.
It was something that was quite a frustration to me, actually, when Live Nation bought out Big Champagne. Because I remember having calls with Eric and those guys when I was at PS. Because I was really interested in Big Champagne. I mean, at that point, it's probably down to Eric and his guys to comment, really. But I think they were working more with, across a broader spectrum, including TV companies and stuff. But what I thought was always very interesting is that where Music Metric and Next Big Sound are very much kind of hard numbers type measurements across online services, I think Big Champagne took a step back to take a much broader view of, like, how much are you being talked about in press? How much are you being featured on TV? You know, how many minutes of airtime have you had? And these are all critical real-world factors that I think make a massive difference because... Within my world, I know full well that as great as online marketing is, if you're doing it in a vacuum and you've got, you know, no press, no radio support, nothing else, I mean, you can still do it, but my God, your job is, you know, infinitely more difficult because those are the other factors in the broader world at large. You know, we will finish this conversation and you might walk to the tube station and, you know, you might see posters, you might pick up a magazine on the way and read something, you know, even if it's just a free newspaper. There's all these different things that you by which you can still be touched in the real world
with
you know, an artist of any sort. So,
And there's a correlation problem as well, because, like, if you get data from those services and they don't yet incorporate this sort of information, you end up with half a picture, and then you have to have somebody that is either employed full-time or does it as part of their job to keep track of what's happening in the real world and then try to correlate that with spikes and changes in the social numbers, which, of course, are related. So...
It just
makes more work for, I guess, who's following the artist to really keep track of what's happening on the front.
I think for me, the problem, I mean, I remember we trialed BuzzDeck when I was at PS.
Yeah.
And I mean, I use these services now. I use Music Metric, and I think Music Metric is great. Ironically, I think Music Metric's strongest point is actually as a sort of research tool, because Music Metric keeps historical data on a lot of artists. So, you know, you can see what's gone on in the last year for anyone and see what's their strong points have been and what the weak points have been and stuff like that. So that's great. BuzzDeck was great for me because I was running a lot of these campaigns and I just wanted like a one screen thing of what's happened to gain, you know, a rough bit of insight without having to trawl through Facebook insights, YouTube insights, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But there was a brilliant example when we were working on the C6 Steve campaign where he was appearing on Later with Jules Holland. And we had this kind of marked as a flag in the sand on BuzzDeck. And he went on Jules Holland. And there was a massive spike in hits to his website and everything else. And we all sat there kind of high-fiving because we thought Jules Holland had sort of done it again, you know. And it was all brilliant. And what we'd missed, or what BuzzDeck had missed, I suppose, was that on the same day and almost at exactly the same time, Steve had signed to Third Man Records in the States. And Jack White had stuck Steve on the front of Third Man Records website and run a huge press release, and that's what drove all the views. And it's only when you dug in that you realized all the views were going, you know, through an embed on Third Man of the video. And And it's a perfect example of where BuzzDeck got it wrong. You know, if we'd have just gone with their data, you'd have looked at it and gone, oh, great, high five. We've all had done a great job with Leighton Jules Holland. It doesn't work like that. You know, and I think that's the problem with all the metrics companies is until they're literally a kind of all-seeing eye of popular culture, then they are inherently a little flawed.
Yeah, sure. Well, I wanted to close the show by just mentioning, I guess there's nothing to talk about really inherently about this, but I mentioned the fact that the FBI released their latest report yesterday. I haven't managed to read it all through. It's like 34 pages. But the takeaway is that this year was the last year 2012 was the first time where the IFPI global recorded music revenues appeared to rise by even if by a measly 0.3%. But that's the first rise recorded since 1999. So even if it's small, it's certainly a measure of some hope for the industry. And on the global front, of course, you know, we're seeing so many services expand internationally. So from iTunes, which is now in 150 something countries, to, you know, 7 Digital keeps expanding. Deezer is now in a bunch of countries where many other services are not. So I guess on a worldwide level, we can only hope that the revenues are going to grow, if anything, because of the availability of services in more territories. But you know, there's also a question of, you know, of course, adoption and all that. That's a different matter. But I don't know, Matt. Any comments on this one?
I'm more skeptical than you are. We've taken a Dell out of those numbers. What we have seen a rise, and seen another fantastic year. We're still really dependent on big spiky artists like we always have been. It hasn't really changed.
Yeah.
And I would be happier to see a much more ground level rise. It was good to see albums up. That's always positive. I like seeing people buy things. If we end up in an only singles world, I'm going to be really sad. For a variety of personally and cultural, I think it's a bad thing. But to see the album stuff go, that's a positive note for me.
Yeah.
Less positive though is that I think that the number of new services that are bringing new types of revenue in aren't growing as fast as I would like to see.
No.
You know, and you talked about the money in the moneymaker section. It's coming from live. It's coming from a lot of those places. If P looks at you know, recorded music stuff, and I think we're going to have to recognize that number is not that healthy, and that growth is never going to bring us back to big numbers, and we're never going to get to those numbers. It's going to be smaller, and I hope that smaller world is a little more interesting than just spikes from, as lovely as Adele is, I hope it's not just massive spikes from things like that, or from American Idol or Pop Idol kind of stuff.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I think from my side of it, it's kind of it's weird. The two things I took from it, really, I mean, the main ones, how much of it recognized a broader global market, because I think, you know, it's possibly bordering on a racist comment, I suppose, but it feels like in America particularly, they like to focus on America when they're talking about markets, and they don't tend to look necessarily beyond America. And I think equally in Europe, we're quite guilty. I mean, the UK is just as guilty of failing to look beyond its own shores, but equally we tend to think the borders tend to stop at the EU and we don't go beyond that. So it's been very interesting to read about Zingana, the Indian kind of streaming service that's really lifting off. And, you know, those, you know, pickups you're seeing in places like India and China, where, you know, so there's a large market between those two, the understatement of the century. But, you know, it's good to see that stuff happening. And I think just because of working with artists and, you know, in music marketing generally, I'm sort of curious to see where that will lead. You know, whether, you know, because the artists I work with at the moment just don't really penetrate those territories at all. You know, I don't know any band I've worked with, you know, now or in the past has ever played in India or, you know, played in China and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, will those become markets that open up slightly more so that, you know, they become just as, you know, casual to us as, you know, we're touring UK, Europe and America.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that was a good thing to see. And I think there's also just a general, you know, half the thing with this is that it's good news.
Yeah.
I think maybe that will just make people think differently and feel a little more proactive. I mean, maybe I'm looking at this with rose-tinted specs, but, you know, everyone's been so down on this stuff for so long that it would be lovely if we just started seeing more of a mindset to kind of, you know, proactive response to this stuff and thinking that maybe this isn't the great behemoth and all of those things. I mean, I'm possibly simplifying it too much, but I think you can never underestimate the value of good news and a general shift in mindset. You know, it goes back to what I was saying about Spotify and Ford's cars. I think the big victory will just be Spotify jumping on the ad platform so that when Ford are running limitless amounts of ads to sell this new service,
yeah,
they get a mention and people will start to recognize the name. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think for those two reasons, I think it was good. It was nice to see.
And it's also going to be a question of seeing how the expansion territorially of services, if it does influence the listening habits or, you know, bring a new audience to bands, whether the new services that are coming up now and hopefully, you know, Songkick's Detour and a few other companies that are doing crowdfunded concerts, or at least some sort of element of crowdfunding in the organization of tours, are going to come in and maybe like try and capitalize on that if they find that, for example, X band has a big following in a random town in India, and for that reason, you know, a concert gets organized and gets off the ground in a way that it wouldn't really happen otherwise nowadays. I mean, the only act that I've really had a work account where I was following a bunch of like high profile acts just to see what their activity was, and like I was always surprised by seeing where Lady Gaga was playing, for example, because she seemed to be playing in the most random places that I would have never thought she would be going to. And I guess because she has that global reach, it would be great to see smaller bands be able to get a little bit of that and be able to really extend a little bit what they can do right now. And I guess Matt, with your experience at LastFM, you probably saw some of those spikes happening for some bands, maybe of like,
yeah,
them becoming popular in territories where they're not from.
You know, we always really encourage and try to get people to use it. And I think we could have done a much better job of working with managers and CBS invested in those parts of the product. We would have done better off, I think. But really, the data that you get back, and Troy Carter, Gaga's manager, is famous for using the data from Spotify to help adjust the tour, right? I mean, he uses the data to know what tracks they should be playing. And he takes the time to be informed about the places they're going. If you end up in Belarus and you know the most popular track is not Poker Face but X, lead with that song. You know, that response builds this. When I was working at Sony, we work with Avril Lavigne, and Avril and her management were just phenomenal at understanding when they went international, right? And they had the resources, and they used the big resources of the big labels to the absolute best effect. You know, and I assume Taylor Swift does the same thing. The big machine, literally and figuratively, are the kind of companies who go out there and really understand and use the data to make better decisions when they go to those markets.
Yeah.
And I think I asked Simon Willow that once on a panel he was on once. I said, do you use any data when you talk about international and reaching more fans that way? And he kind of dismissed it, which I think is a bit of a mistake. I think he does. I think he wouldn't admit it on the stage that he used any of the data stuff. But I think the ones that do are the ones that win.
Yeah.
And to get to a bigger audience, which we all want to see more bands be more heard, you've got to start using the data to inform the cultural decisions and the gut level decisions you're making.
Yeah, sure. All right. Well, I think we're come to the end of the show. It's been about an hour, so about right. I just wanted to ask you guys if you have anything that you want to plug or talk about, either companies you work with or that are in a new band for you or a release or anything like that. I don't know, Matt?
Nope, nothing to plug today.
Okay, cool. Darren?
I'm sure there's a million things. You know what? I've had about 4 hours sleep. I literally can't remember any of them.
Great. I'll do a plug for you, actually. If you head on to motiveunknown.com, is that right?
Yeah.
You should subscribe. Darren does a cool daily like summary of music industry news. So if you head on to motiveunknown.com, you can subscribe to the Daily Digest, it's called, and there's a link over there, and you can get this daily email delivered to your inbox with some of the latest news in the tech industry, music tech industry. So that's great.
Yeah, that was my plug. Well, awesome. Well done, Andrea.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming on, and I hope to see you guys again soon on the show.
Thanks. Take care, guys.
And thanks for listening.
Yes. Digital Music Trends is available on a variety of channels. Visit digitalmusictrends.com for more information and subscribe to the newsletter for weekly updates. Have a great week, and until next time.